Winter Spaces.
An interdisciplinary podcast.
Welcome back to Interspaces, the science podcast of SIF, a center for interdisciplinary research based at Bielefeld University. I'm Rebecca Moltmann and I'm looking forward to today's episode. It is a little different than the episodes we have done so far regarding the composition of my guests. Usually we have 1 to 3 researchers from groups working at SIF. Today I will be talking with a research group convener and 2 coaches supporting the work process of the research group. One goal or question we always think about at SIF is how to support our fellows and their work in the best ways possible, since they have to combine all the different disciplinary backgrounds, methods, and research cultures in a few months of working together. Coming to terms with these differences often takes up quite some of the joint research time. How is it possible to avoid more of the frictional losses and the possible dissatisfaction with the interdisciplinary work? For our current resident research group, Mapping Evidence to Theory in Ecology, addressing the challenges of generalization and causality, a special kind of group work process came into being, and we want to learn everything about that today from the research group convener Tina Heger and the coaches Nora Pfitzenreuter and Oliver Sass. Could you introduce yourselves, who you are, what your areas of expertise are, etc.? Maybe Tina Heger can begin.
Yes, sure. Thanks. I'm happy to be here and being invited to contribute to this podcast. My name is Tina Heger and I'm an ecologist by training. My research has for a long time focused on invasive alien species, so species that spread outside of their native ranges. And I have become interested in research synthesis early on. So my overall topic in most of what I'm doing is how can we bring together research results from different studies and thus learn most from previous studies that have been made.
Thank you very much. Also from my side, my name is Nora Pfitzenreuter. I'm a business psychologist, so this is my background. And currently I'm working self-employed as an organizational developer and systemic coach. So my areas of expertise, I would say, is mainly topics like collaboration within teams or also in between teams in organizations, team development, for example. And goal setting is also one of the big topics currently. So yeah, these are the main 3 topics that I'm involved in the moment. And I would say most of my career has taken place in agile ways of working. I think we will come to that in a second, but this is mainly the area of the working style that I'm most familiar with, I would say.
My name is Oliver Sass. I'm a designer by trade, and design can be looked at as a process or as the outcome. I'm very interested in the process, always have been interested in the process of designing. We're coming to that a little bit later. I'm also a professor for design management at Makomedia University at Campus Munich, and I'm the head of the study program MA Design Management, an international study program focusing on design innovation and design-driven innovation.
As you may notice, it's a very broad field of people and knowledge we have collected together here for this episode, and we will cover quite some ground. But I think we should start with a research group and first understanding what the group is about. Maybe you could, I mean, you already did in a way, but maybe you could explain the idea and the goal of the research group again, Tina.
So the goal of this research group is to find ways how we can leverage the newest advances in computational sciences for ecology and for applications like, for example, restoration. So restoration today is key because this is a very good way to counter the biodiversity crisis. But what is lacking for doing efficient and effective restoration is a solid knowledge base. And there is a lot of research going on in ecology that is relevant for restoration. But this knowledge is spread across a diversity of sources. And so the goal here is to find out how we can make this knowledge, ecological knowledge, better accessible for example, restoration practice. And so the aim is to first find out where this knowledge sits. So which are all the different sources? It's not only scientific publications. It's also what we call gray literature, for example, but also expertise of the people that are working, for example, in restoration projects. And second, then to make this knowledge available. So in nowadays, this means to build a huge database or a knowledge graph that can contain all this knowledge. And then third, find a good way how this can then become accessible to people. So with other words, building an interface that is useful for the practitioners. And this is not only about building some software, but it's also involves a lot of decisions that need to be made on, so which kinds of knowledge do we integrate? How, what does it mean if we account for different sources of knowledge? Do we have to weigh them, or how can we account for differences in how this knowledge has been gained? And how can we account for a diversity of user groups also? All these kind of conceptual questions need to be taken into account. That's the overall topic. Thus, it's not only to come up with some ideas for such a web tool, but also to think deeply about the conceptual things and challenges that we are facing when we want to do this kind of knowledge synthesis.
I think you can already hear that there have to be quite some different people from different fields to really tackle a subject like that. Who did you gather as fellows regarding the disciplines to get closer to that goal?
Mm-hmm. So quite obviously, ecologists and restoration, not practitioners, we don't have those, but scientists that work in restoration. And then, of course, computer scientists from different branches. And third, philosophers of science, because I think it's really essential to have people on board who are trained with conceptual thinking. And there is a group forming in philosophy that especially takes ecology in its, in their focus. And so I try to get philosophers, especially who are interested in how ecology works.
For me, it sounds quite ambitious to use new approaches from fields like artificial intelligence, for example, to ideally come to an understanding of why things are happening in complex ecosystems. Do you think innovative projects like that benefit more, or especially from also breaking new ground regarding methods and regarding how to set up the research process in itself?
Yeah, I totally think so. I would say at least in our group, from the start, I had the feeling that this is so big and complex that I urgently need help. And therefore, I thought it might be a very good idea to have coaches on board that can help with structuring this time that we have the opportunity to spend together. And since also because this is such a huge idea, I wasn't sure how to best deal with the fact that we only have 6 months and how we can structure our work so that we can make most of this time. And therefore, I think it was really key to get the two coaches on board.
We have here two experts for innovative methods like that. Maybe you think about that differently because you're thinking about design thinking and methods like Scrum for a long time. But I think for a lot of people, that's still very new and very unusual, maybe also in the scientific community. But could you tell us a little bit more about things like design thinking and Scrum and methods you are using, or maybe more methods like these? What did you think of when you first heard about the project in terms of, we could do maybe this or that?
Maybe I can begin and we can just ping pong amongst us, because I think especially design thinking and then working with other agile methodologies, there's a high interrelation, I would say. So it's a very good combination that we found here with the three of us. So, and why would I say that? Coming back to your question, as Tina said, it's a highly complex environment that we are in there. The research question has a high complexity. And for especially these types of questions, like complex questions, agile methodologies are a very good opportunity to organize yourself. And because you cannot really make a strict plan about what has to happen, what is the output, what is, you know, like it's not possible to nail that down from the start. And after 6 months, you have exactly that. You should have, of course, a good idea of the value or of the outcome you want to achieve, but you cannot really drill that down too detailed from the start. And I think these are environments or questions where you can make use of agile methodologies, especially like design thinking, like Oliver will tell you a bit about that. And we use then some elements of the agile framework Scrum. And maybe, Oliver, would you like to start? Because we did that in more or less this order to begin with design thinking. And then I can take over to tell a bit about why we choose Scrum elements. Maybe that makes sense.
Absolutely. Thank you. Yeah, let me start a little bit broader what design thinking really is. It is it's interesting because it's a concept and a methodology. So it's a way of thinking, it's a way of approaching things in general, but it's also a quite methodological framework that we can work with. So having a starting point, having an end point, and so forth. So with certain steps we can follow. One should know that design thinking has developed over several decades, taking inspiration from fields like industrial design, coming from industrial design, but also engineering, architecture, most importantly, psychology and management. And over time, it has actually transformed into a structured framework for creative problem solving, making it more accessible and applicable far beyond its usual design roots, if you will. Meaning we're using design as a methodological approach, but using all kinds of different approaches within this concept to try to achieve what we want to achieve. And at its core, design thinking is a human-centered, iterative approach to tackling problems, all kinds of problems. It focuses on understanding the needs of users, but most importantly, it is challenging existing assumptions and redefining problems and crafting, at the end, innovative solutions. So originally, as I said already, design thinking is rooted in the practices of designers. Its adaptability, if you will, and focus on collaboration have led to its adoption in a wide range of fields. Today, design thinking is used not only in business, but also education, healthcare, social innovation, but also increasingly in scientific research. Its emphasis on interdisciplinary collaboration and problem reframing, as I said earlier, makes it an exciting and valuable tool for advancing interdisciplinary scientific inquiry and addressing complex real-world challenges.
I have a question regarding the, I think that was kind of the definition, the human-centered aspect. So is that regarding what the resident research group is doing, focused on the researchers as the, I don't know, like drivers of the research? So it's human-centered in terms of how you design the work process is important regarding who's working on it and not at the forefront what they are working on?
If I understand correctly, I would answer that it's not so much about doing actual research within this research group, but finding ways of collaborating, really, and finding ways of visualizing information, for instance, also helping to communicate certain content. I would come a little bit more back to that at a later point to be more clear how we actually worked. But this is a little bit the general perspective on design thinking, what it can do. There's a little bit of confusion out there that it is this sort of easy way of finding very innovative solution at the end. Of course, this is not quite true. We have to work hard in that sense and have to find solutions in the process. So we are trying to work together in a way that helps us to identify insights that help us to drive this whole project further. And this is an interesting aspect. So it's not so much about how we make all these researchers already now to design researchers or something like that, or human-centered researchers, but rather using these methods in design thinking to help the whole research group to communicate better, to work together better, more efficiently, but also more profoundly. And this is obviously a quite challenging task.
Yeah, exactly. So the topics that I was mainly driving, how did they come into play and how did they connect to design thinking? So as Oliver said, design thinking, like one of the outcomes is that we have ideas for solutions to these complex questions at hand. And now comes the part where you want to get these solutions, like bring them into life, like build them basically to operationalize the ideas and to say, okay, what does that really mean? What do we have to build now? And this is where agile frameworks like, for example, Scrum comes into play. Yeah, so Scrum is one of many so-called agile frameworks. And as I said, it's basically a way how you can build a product or a service or whatever. And what is the difference between, of course, many other ways how you can build something is working with agile methodologies has the aim of reducing the risk that you build something that your end users or customers or whoever you build it for will not use it. Like it wants to prevent you from building the wrong thing, so to say. So you want to reverse, you want to build something that has a very high value for the outside world. So this is actually what you're aiming for. And if I want to drill it down and try to put it in a nutshell, we want to achieve this, like achieving the right product in the end, by planning and building step by step. So this is also what Oliver said about the iterative approach. This is also the case in Scrum. We have certain timeframes, and in these timeframes, we plan what we want to do and what we want to achieve. Then we do that. Then we have a result. Best case, something that is tangible or visible, and we can show that to our customers, to our users, whoever we are doing this for. And we can gather feedback on the results, and then we can see, are we still on the right way? And if not, we can adjust. And if we are on the right way, we can move on. But you always have these points in time where you have a result and you can gather feedback and then you can move on. And this is especially coming back to the complexity that Tina mentioned. So this is especially important when we have this high complexity context where you cannot foresee too far in the future and can make an exact plan. Because if you could do that, then you don't need these feedback loops. You could just rush through your to-do list and just do the things for half a year. But in this complex environments, you're embracing the fact that you don't know everything yet from the start. And if you go step by step, you have a higher probability that you will in the end really reach your intended goals and the intended value that you want to create. And maybe another point that is similar to what Oliver said about design thinking and the human-centered design is also true in Scrum, that it's very customer focused. So as I said, we want to always see what is most valuable for the people that we are building our stuff for and want to integrate them. Of course, having also an eye on what can we actually do, what is feasible, for example, technically, or what is wanted, like strategically or so. But we also take into account our customers very importantly. That is something that stands out and that helps us to put the resources that we have in the limited time, the limited amount of people, to put all the efforts in the right direction.
I think it's interesting, even when I think about like the word customer, I can already imagine there are some scientists and researchers out there who think, customer, what's she talking about? And I claimed that it's still quite unusual to use methods or frameworks like this for scientific research or research processes. But Oliver, you said that it's increasingly used more in fields like these. So was it a lie what I just said? And how do you think it gets welcomed by researchers? Because I mean, I've been working at university for quite some time now, and I really still know a lot of people who are already afraid of post-its. And it's like, oh my God, now I have to do some kind of method. So there is a lot of like Berührungsangst. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of hesitation towards methods like these. So how did you perceive this challenge?
That's a very interesting point that you're touching here, because I mean, I've been working with big companies, small companies, medium companies in innovation fields, if you will, in projects to drive innovation. And this innovation can relate to a product in the end, or it could be a service, or it could be a system, or it could be about transforming the organization itself. So bringing with me this experience, I know exactly what this hesitation is about. This is the story of design thinking, that a more design-driven and a more human-centered approach was very critically viewed a couple of decades ago. So this was a very natural behavior in organizations, that they had their very experienced way of developing new things within the organization. Why should they do it differently? But what the experience now shows over these two or three decades, where it became really prominent in the world, in the business world, if I may say so, and many companies have actually transformed entirely to become a much more design thinking driven organization on all kinds of levels. They learned along the way that creativity is so important in competition, and particularly when it comes to innovation, naturally, of course. So looking at the scientific group here as an innovation project, if you will, rather than just an exchange of knowledge, but really trying to come up with a solution. So it's actually an innovation project. And so this experience that we bring with us here into this project is so helpful if we look at the project entirely differently. So we say we want to have a tangible, we want to have a meaningful outcome. This is exactly what Tina was aiming for with her research group. There's also the idea to drive research further, creating new research directions and so forth. But it's also about to come up with a real product in the end that can be used in a meaningful way in real life, in the real world. And for that reason, design thinking is such an excellent way to bring interdisciplinary groups also together. Because as Nora already mentioned, the process is flexible. It's super important to keep it flexible. It's inclusive, and it really encourages problem solving along the way. And most importantly, it helps people from different fields to collaborate more easily. breaking down these typical disciplinary barriers that we face that can sometimes really get in the way. So it is, from my point of view, a really good tool to turn scientific insights into actionable ideas and make science communication a lot clearer and more engaging in the process. And this science communication is so important because we talk about different fields we're working in, different scientific fields where communication is not always as easy or so, naturally coming from different scientific cultures as well.
Just a little side story, because I can remember very clearly the moment, like the first week, I think, when the project started and we all were together with the group. Oliver, you had the design thinking days with the group, and then I came in to, as Oliver said, put these now very actionable outcomes kind of onto a timeline, like seeing, okay, what do you want to achieve in the end? And then what would that mean for the months ahead and so on? So I tried really to break that down and put that into a kind of structure, I would say. And as you said, there was definitely a high hesitation or some critical voices saying, ooh, this is research. How can we put this in such a rigid structure? So I can highly relate to that feeling or to these thoughts. And I think we, yeah, of course, we saw that, we heard that, and we adopted. So of course, we always said, okay, let's see what is useful with these approaches, with these Scrum elements that we presented. What is useful to use? How much structure is useful? And where do you need the freedom to explore, to exchange, to come up with ideas and so on and so forth? So that was definitely something like a challenge or something that was very clear from the start that I think that's kind of special when you have the scientific context and these methods coming together. So the balance, finding a good balance between freedom and exploration and non-structure, and then having a certain structure and planning and so on and so forth. So I can highly relate to that. But I think we found a good way, Tina, if you would agree to that.
Yeah, totally. I would totally agree. And I think the basic points have already been made by you, Oliver and Nora. But from my point of view, also, it also depends, of course, on the personalities of the people. So we had some in the group that were really open from the start to everything and enjoyed every bit and piece of the exercises we did. And of course, there were others that kind of were quite reluctant, and some are still, I would say, a little bit at least. But yeah, I think on average, it worked totally fine. So people got into these habits of having a structure to the day and to the week and to the months. And I think most of our participants really enjoyed having this agile structure. And also the design thinking workshops that we had, I think most, if not all, of the participants really felt the benefits of it, and that these design thinking exercises helped to come to a common language, to leave behind our disciplinary language, and also the hierarchies. You can leave behind the hierarchies also with these exercises. When we, for example, in the first week together did some Lego building high towers and stuff. So there was a very nice way to kind of set the way we communicate in the group and to show everyone that you can communicate easily. You don't need to carry your jargon. There's ways how you can communicate with others beyond these disciplinary boundaries. And also you can do it in a playful way. That I think was also a very nice way. And this playfulness also was really happening with these Scrum elements, because we have this huge board in our working room, the Kanban board, where we use the sticky notes to plan our day. And it's really fun activities. People were experiencing that it can be so much fun to move a sticky note from doing to done. And we began writing more and more sticky notes to represent all the fine-grained tasks so that we can move more from one day to the next. So all these things are really fun ways of bringing structure to the work. So I think for most, if not all, of the participants, this worked very well.
I think that's such an important aspect, that you can loosen hierarchies, and especially the beginning of getting together, coming together as a group. And as I said, research cultures can be quite different. So I studied literary studies, and it's so different than someone who comes from biology or physics or whatever. And I think that's a really interesting point, maybe for researchers who would be interested in doing something like that for their research subjects, that it can really help to loose the jargon, as you said, because it's like people I think they kind of hide behind jargon often, especially if you don't really know the outcome yet. So you don't really have the expertise maybe at that point, or you feel uncertain about the outcome, and then you kind of hide behind your terminology. And I think that can be very challenging to really get a group going. So judging from a perspective of looking at interdisciplinary groups for years. And as I was talking about the friction and losses, so I think that's really a big point. I mean, if you take up 3 or 4 months to just find a language to talk to each other, then the time is, like, if you have a 6-month research project, the time is almost over. And then what have you done? And I mean, for some groups, 3 months would be great. Some groups don't even get to the point where they have a common language. And I think that's so interesting for interdisciplinary group work to think about factors like that. How did you come to the idea? So did you have any experience with methods like these? Or why did you choose to let the group be driven by this framework?
So yeah, I have some experience with design thinking because Oliver and me have been collaborating before in a different context. So this design thinking idea was when Oliver and me was talking about this resident group at ZIF, he was saying, yeah, you know, these design thinking techniques, that could also be applied to that context. And that was one train of thought. And the other was that I have heard about these Scrum techniques and have experienced a little bit of that because I was involved with a computer scientist in a study program where they used that. And I was, for one study program, I was a Scrum master. So that's the other opportunity where I met some experience with these techniques. And then when planning this research group, I really felt the challenge that I cannot tell what will be the result in 6 months' time. And so how do I want to plan this whole thing? And then I thought, I guess these agile techniques, they could really help. So I think that's how it came.
So to understand the process better, Oliver and Nora, how did you get acquainted with the topic of regroup? Did you dive deeply into the research itself and try to understand what they're trying to do? Or did you have a little idea about that and then just make a few suggestions to Tina and then work on that together? Or how did you get to the point where you could say, ah, okay, that's maybe the perfect way to go, or the first ideas for the framework to work as a group?
If I may start, Tina and I, we started to work at a very early point together. How can we implement design thinking overall approach to these 6 months somehow? And so we thought about how can we use design thinking best? So we came up with the idea to implement certain workshop phases rather than going through every week through some exercises or so. We have a workshop phase 1, we have a workshop phase 2 for almost a week every phase. And then I started to build, basically try to construct the whole week. What are we going to do the whole week? And what are we planning to achieve in this week? And we may not forget that we have a very complex situation with very diverse viewpoints. And as we mentioned already earlier, very diverse research cultures and knowledge fields and so forth. How do we use this most efficiently? How can we create an environment, first of all, that makes everything possible, that we can engage in all kinds of different conversations, maybe even beyond the typical explicit knowledge, as we call it. So thinking also about the implicit side of science, what knowledge do I have that I cannot that easily communicate and that builds in the process of this workshop? And this is, for me, highly fascinating to see this, how these conversations are building. And in the due process, we get all kinds of new insights along the way. So the whole thing feels in a way very chaotic, but it isn't. It's organized and very well planned. And yet it needs to be super flexible along the way, because Tina and I were always sitting every evening together. So what did we achieve? What would be the best approach for the next day? Where are we standing as a team and team motivation? Where are we standing with the outcomes? What would be a sensible step as the next step? But it needs, as I said earlier, a long phase of planning what methods might be useful and what methods need to be adapted and changed along the way to make it more useful in this scientific context. We have to understand that many people think that it's a pretty straightforward process, design thinking, as I mentioned at the very early beginning of our conversation. But if you look at it carefully and you want to look at every step of this process very carefully, you need to understand that it's also the process can be very complex in itself. And you have to think about what are the meaningful methods that can be used in every step that make really sense. And for that reason, I think it makes absolutely sense to continuously view the process and not think one size fits all. We just create an easy process, the typical design thinking process, and at the end, everybody will be happy. This is not going to work. So we have to make the effort to discuss these in-depth aspects of the project. And coming back to your question, and then I hopefully will be finished with my part here, is that, yes, it is important to really deep dive into the topic. There's no way that the process itself, this is my big learning here, can just be organized from the outside. I have to be in the middle of the process. In the beginning, I was very shy to interfere, bringing in my own experiences into the process. But in the process of this week or so, I got a little bit more relaxed and started to become more an active part while monitoring and moderating the process.
Okay. So from my point, I could say that I can also say what Oliver said. It was also with the Scrum elements, it was a very, say, carefully crafted approach or process, I would say. And I would even say that we practiced what we preach, that it was also an agile process in a way. What do I mean by this? So if you would just go and say, okay, let's implement Scrum here in this group, you know, then you would have this one-fits-all approach that Oliver said that was not the case. So Scrum is, as I said, a framework, and it contains certain roles and events and artifacts like working boards, certain rhythms, and so on and so forth. So there's a huge thing behind it. And instead of just taking it and applying it and that's it, I took a bit of preparation, of course, with Tina in order to really find out what problems do you want to solve? You know, like, why would you want to choose certain aspects of this framework? So first, I wanted to understand about the group, about the challenges, not so much about the topic. So of course, I'm curious and I wanted to know what the group was working on. But that is, for my job, it's not so necessary to really know the details of the topic, even though it's very interesting. But I did not dive too much into that, but rather dived into the group situation and the challenges over there. And so to see which problems do we want to solve. And then I took a look on the Scrum framework and together with Tina decided or made a proposal and said, hey, I think these and these elements would fit well. What do you think? And then together we crafted a first version, so to say, where we thought, okay, this will help the challenges of the group best. And the challenges were, Tina, correct me if I'm wrong, but the main challenges were, how can we have a good transparency over where are we in the project and what needs to be done still and so on, because many people in the project, they came and some went, and you know, some were only there for some days or some weeks, and you needed to constantly onboard people. Mm-hmm. And it was very crucial to have a quick idea for them, like, where are we, what is needed right now, and so on. So this was one big thing. And the other one was the dynamics. So one is the transparency, one is how can we get people onboarded and so. So it was a bit connected. Yeah. And for that, we thought, okay, it would be good to have something like a lot of visibility of the process. So for example, for this, we choose certain work boards that Tina mentioned already, like a Kanban board and a very big overall big picture board showing all the 6 months and the milestones, what do we want to reach and where are we and so on. So that was something like these two boards I presented. That was the next step after having an idea of what things from the Scrum framework would work well. We presented that to the group and gathered feedback and thoughts around that. And then we integrated it and said, okay, let's start with this. And then after introducing these first elements, that was what I would call an agile process. The group always took some action with these items and then they gave feedback. Okay, how is it to work in this way? What should we do differently? So I think once per month, more or less, we had a certain meeting, a retrospective it's called, where we came together and reflected on the last weeks. How was the collaboration? How was the work with these artifacts and the meetings and so on? And then we always had the chance to make things better, you know, along the process regarding our working elements. And that was why I would call it was agile in itself, how we worked with these elements.
So we heard quite a lot already, of course, about different steps you took and things you did together as a group. But maybe to really be able to imagine what you're doing in these workshop phases, maybe you could walk us through like an exemplary day of workshopping together.
Yeah, I'm happy to do so. First of all, maybe I want to start again with the fact that it's so important to have a project leader like Tina, who's really willing to experiment with these methods and with these approaches. And as Tina mentioned earlier, not everybody is welcoming that right away. So it takes a while. So you have to have a convincing leader to give it a try. And Tina did this very well. So for that reason, the chances are much higher to come to any successful day or week or so if you have somebody who's really making an effort to try new approaches and see what comes out of this. And to answer your questions, what is a typical day? Well, first of all, I think it's super important to understand that scholars from different fields, as we discussed many times now earlier, have these different research cultures, but also they have these different personal mentalities here. We have very different people. We have to acknowledge that. Very different people in their mentality and their energy and their willingness to communicate and so forth. So we have to find bridges here. For instance, if you may remember, Tina, that the first day we tried an exercise where all the participants, and you participated here as well, to express themselves and their understanding of this overall project and their expectations for this project in a completely different way. Going beyond language, using visual metaphors, as we call that. So using abstract motifs, cutting out colors, shapes, and stuff like that, and create assemblages that we hang at the walls to express ourselves. And this is obviously something that is, I believe, quite unheard of in the scientific field. But what happened is along the way that people see that we are all, and this is I'm coming back now to the human-centeredness of this project, that we are all humans next to being scholars and scientists. We are real humans and we have our energies day one, not so much energy the next day, or we feel insecure. And we heard these feedbacks from the participants that they said, now I feel really encouraged to ask really not so comfortable questions and also expose myself that I have no clue what the other person is talking about. And this is the basis really for any sort of interdisciplinary work. Otherwise, how can we even get started? So this is the typical starting point that we try to warm up people to using a different way of communication. And this takes a while, so we have to use our time really useful here in that sense and give it some time that people start to explore that. What does it do for me? So it's not just an exercise and hopefully we're done soon. Yeah? No, but we try to see what it actually transforms in the team here as a motivational factor. And this worked really pretty well in our case. And then we start to move a little bit more into more concrete questions gradually, but still using similar methods. Every day we're using methods that embody knowledge, so take externalize knowledge somehow, as you talked about earlier about the fear of using a post-it already, yeah? But being much more extreme and using our hands and our brains and work together somehow to express all kinds of levels of knowledge that we can work with. So we embody, we work artistically, and we try to continuously communicate about these aspects. And this holds the promise really to find a lot of very interesting perspectives nobody has ever thought about before. I think this is the key element here, that we are on a journey really to discover new things in this mutual working situation together. So everybody's keeping their discipline, and the interdisciplinarity means that we're discovering something new, new ideas, new concepts, new perspectives. And this is what we do throughout the day, usually opening up for many different perspectives. There's a typical approach in design. We call it a double diamond approach, or many diamonds, if you will. It's about diverging and converging. So we usually try to create even more complexity in the process and then synthesize the material that we've created at a later point. And this is making things big again, if you will, with many different perspectives, and then trying to merge this to something that we find meaningful. And this is a continuous process throughout the day. And in the end of the day, usually participants have learned to use these visual metaphors. They start to use them quite intuitively. So they speak more in terms of this feels like, talking about feelings and understanding knowledge a little bit differently. And they also are much more comfortable to express personal expectations and also difficulties in the process. So because we cannot accept that for everyone it's so easy to engage with other disciplines. And then hopefully we have some results we can work with in the next day and build on that every day, as I said. This is a typical day of workshops, if you will.
Okay. I don't know, Tina, do you want to explain the Thursday structure or should I? You can choose.
I don't mind. So maybe you.
Yep. Oh, okay, good. Okay, maybe you can add on with some stories along this. So one, say, typical structure that we implemented containing some of the Scrum elements is how to structure the, say, Project Thursday. So Thursday was the one day in the week where the whole group worked really together on the topic. And we said, okay, how do we want to give that a certain structure? So as I said, everyone is on board, everyone knows what's going on. And on the same time, one day is not a lot of time. So we want to make it as efficient as possible. So every Thursday then starts with a little check-in. And that means really everyone is in the same room. So we are working physically together in a room. Everyone is standing, at least it was in the beginning, everyone was standing up. And okay, now we are starting the day. And everyone just quickly, or like briefly, says, okay, how am I here today? How do I feel? So that is the first thing. So we are kind of connecting to each other, knowing, okay, how is the other person doing? And so on and so forth. Little side story, by the way, that was something very new to everyone, I think. So that was something people needed to get used to a bit. And maybe we're a bit, maybe a little shy at the beginning because it was just new to talk about this in a round like that. But as I heard from day two on, or like from the second day on, it already became a routine and people were asking for it. And so it obviously had a value in itself. So check-in is the first point. Then we have like a 10, maximum 15 minutes planning of the day, it's called. So we have a close look. We come to one of the boards, so the physical boards, where we pin the post-its with the tasks that we want to do today. We pin them and we, of course, always see, okay, what is necessary? What do we need to do in order to achieve our next goals, which we can see on the overall big picture board that is in the room as well. So we can always see, are we in the right direction and do our task contribute to these goals? So that's one next step. And with this, we're building kind of the schedule for the day. So we know, okay, what is going on? Who will lead the session? How long does it take? And so in the end, you really have like a scheduled day that you can orientate along and everyone knows it because it's transparent in the room. Everyone can take a look. Of course, then there's lunch. We always have the same sticky like lunchtime. And after lunch, there's a little synchronization again, like maybe 5 minutes or 10 maybe to see, okay, where are we? Did we do everything we wanted to do in the morning? And how is the afternoon looking like? So just a little brief synchronization, and maybe we need to do some changes in the schedule. Of course, there's the coffee and cake part that is also very crucial at 3:30. And so this is also a fixed point. And in the end, I think around 5 in the afternoon, there's a little closing part where just everyone comes together and closes the day, like to see, okay, what have we done? What have we maybe not done? What do we need to do next week or so? So I have a little outlook already. So everyone is kind of prepared and has the same view on the day and the outcomes. And this is one typical structure for the Project Thursday. Yeah. Tina, do you want to add something on that? Or?
Yeah, I think that covered it quite well. Although we have to admit that over time, parts of that structure kind of went lost a little. For example, think after the lunch and also the closing, that did not happen every Thursday, I would say. But very importantly is that we had this the morning check-in and planning of the day. And so this is the structure for our typical Thursdays. And then over the rest of the week, we also have these daily meetings. So we have every day except Tuesdays, because they are our non-SIP work days. Because at some point in time, we realized also with the help of Nora that we were so kind of under stress with all the other topics that kept piling up that are not related to our SIF group topic. And so we decided that we need one day where everyone is allowed to do non-SIF work. Yeah, so that's a Tuesday. But on the Monday, the Wednesday and the Friday, we have our 10 o'clock daily where we come together in our group room and have this quick check-in and then take a look at what we have achieved yesterday and move the sticky note to done and then come up with new sticky notes for what we want to do today and structure our day together and discuss who will be there for lunch, where do we go for lunch, and do we need for coffee and these kind of things. And this is really something that helped us so much, and that's also a lot of fun, and it's guaranteeing that we are working as a group. So still, and there are many days when the 10 o'clock meeting is the only time we really come together to work together. And afterwards, people are doing their separate things, but still, we have this 10 o'clock meeting to think and to figure out what makes sense to do together. So this is key, I would say, and it's fun for everyone.
I think that's always good advertising, because things that seem kind of strict, having a structure like that, but they can be also fun. And I think they can be very helpful, even because research is different than like going to work at 8 to having to be there at this point in time and do this and this and that until 5 o'clock, because research can be all over the place. So I think that's very nice. Considering that the group is almost coming to an end, February will be the last month. So you've been working for 5 months now. Are you happy with the results so far?
I'm super happy. I wouldn't have expected that from the start, I have to say. It worked out much better than I expected. So I'm super, super happy. So I think one key thing that happened is that because we had from the start this very open and collaborative overall feeling created by these workshops, that it happened that people took on responsibilities. I didn't have to plan everything myself, and I didn't have to tell people what to do. But they took on responsibilities themselves. They kept coming up with new ideas for subgroups and stuff to do and so on, and took on work that they felt is the thing that needs to be done right now and so on. And therefore, we got so much more done than I expected. And we just recently had one of our... So in addition to these coached workshops, we also had 2 workshops without any coaches. So like our disciplinary or no... These are interdisciplinary, but I mean, these, I would say, usual research workshops. And the recent one we had just last week, it was so super productive. I'm still blown away. So that's really cool. And I can also feel, or also got the feedback from the participants, that they really appreciate the atmosphere. And I think that is something that was so much enhanced by these workshops we had with design thinking, and also the retrospectives where people were asked to give their feedback on the process also and on the communication. All these things were really super important parts, I think, to make this so successful.
Nice to hear. The coaches are happy about that. Do you have any advice for researchers who would be interested in using design thinking or Scrum or Agile methodologies in general? Mm-hmm. So how can they approach this? How can they start? What's a good thing to tell people?
I would say key is to find the people that match personally. So it worked so well because we got along so well personally, I would say, me and the coaches. And I think that is key. So find a coach that you can work with and be open to their suggestions. And also the coaches need to be really listening to what's the need of the group and the group lead. And I would say in our case, it just worked out perfectly. And I wish everyone the good luck to have the same experience.
Oliver and Nora, do you have any advice for researchers who would like to try methods like these?
Yeah, I think I can relate to some points that Tina mentioned. So just first of all, the openness to try out new things, of course, because it's going to be something new, and the openness to try it out. Because what we saw in the group is, I mean, you can have a lot of thoughts and theories and scribbles and whatever at the start, but you just see how it works when it comes to practice. So this is so important. Mm-hmm. Of course, make your thoughts around which problems do you want to solve, what is your focus, and you know, what challenges do you want to tackle. And then make a draft and see, okay, which elements from these methods do you want to use? Start and try it really, like try it out in reality, and then be open for this iterative approach. Tina was also mentioning, use the retrospectives and see what do you want to change, what do you want to keep. So be open also from the work process point of view to change stuff every now and then. And I think this is very key, like from my point of view. Oliver.
Yeah, from my point of view, I think it is important to really find coaches that don't look at the research group or the topic or the task as the daily business project or so. Every project is entirely different. Of course, different goals, different people, different disciplines are getting involved. From my point of view, is the customization of these processes and approaches the key. So everyone who's planning to do so needs to find somebody who's making the effort to provide a really meaningful plan for this project and not just one size fits all. And we're using the usual methods like we have been using for many, many different projects. I think particular in the interdisciplinary research settings, it needs more effort, really. It needs more planning and ideas before even getting started. And this needs a very close collaboration with the coach and the research leaders and group leaders and so forth. I think this is my most important recommendation, because obviously there's a lot of design thinking out there for businesses and organizations and so forth. Many, many provide just standard programs, and I think this can lead to a disappointment if the individuality of each topic and of each situation is not being acknowledged well enough.
And do you have any tips, literature, podcasts, whatever, for people who would like to get more information on the topics we talked about? But you can also think about that, and then I'm just going to put it in the show notes later.
Okay.
Yeah, okay.
I think this makes sense. Maybe a link or so. Yeah, exactly.
Okay, perfect. Then thank you so much for having been here today and talking to me about that subject. I think it's really, really interesting because it's unusual. I mean, I really work in interdisciplinary environments for like 15 years now, and I think it's really nice to see, and I think it sounds perfect and the outcome sounds really perfect, and I hope everyone who would like to try it is motivated by this podcast now. So thank you very much for today, and yeah, good luck with the last month.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.